anywhere I live.
Intruder alert, intruder alert.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Fighter pilots needed in Sector Wars. Play Astro Blaster.
R2 trying to increase the power.
Welcome back, friends, to the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast. I'm your host, Vic Sage, and for this show, we're going to be taking a look at Namco's 1984 side-scrolling platformer, Pac-Land, one of a few oddities in the family line of Pac-Man titles. Furthermore, I'm expecting a special guest on the show today, none other than Henry Holder, one of the Arcadian kids at the arcade. He said he has something he wants to share with all of us a little later in the episode. Pac-Land was released by Namco in August of 1984, with the North American release being handled by Bally Midway. The designer for Pac-Land was Tsukasa Nigoro, who was also known as Nigi. This 1984 game appears to be his only listing in the databases I have been able to research online. However, the programmer on Pac-Land was Yoshihiro Kishimoto, who was not only the programmer on 1985's Baraduke for Namco, but designed 1986's RBI Baseball, as well as a Famicom-exclusive Star Wars game that was released in 1987. That Star Wars game, I feel I need to add, has a raven-haired Luke Skywalker fighting multiple versions of Darth Vader at the end of each stage. A Darth Vader that can shapeshift into animals like a scorpion and even a shark. The art design for Pac-Land was credited to Hiroshi Ono, who had a hand in the design of 1982's Xevious, in addition to providing art and graphic designs for 1985's Metrocross and even 2015's Galaga Tekken, the 20th Anniversary Edition. This was a Galaga title that allowed for players to choose characters from Tekken instead of the usual spaceship. Last, but certainly not least, was Yuriko Kano, who composed the music used in Pac-Land. And Yuriko definitely has an impressive list of arcade games that she worked on, including being uncredited for the music used in 1982's Xevious. But she also worked on 1982's Super Pac-Man, Pole Position, Dig Dug, Pole Position 2, and Pac-N Pal, to name a few. In 1984, Namco also happened to release such arcade games as The Tower of Druaga, Super Xevious, Gopless, Dragon Buster, Galaga 3, Grobda, and Shootaway. The last one was a projection screen title that simulated skeet shooting. Now, if that starting music from Pac-Land sounded a little familiar, that would be because it's the theme from the popular Pac-Man animated series, produced by Hanna-Barbera, beginning in 1982 and running for 2 seasons. Pac-Man also happened to be the first video game to be adapted into an animated series, but it certainly wasn't the last. In fact, in the North American version released by Bally Midway, the character of Pac-Man and his family resemble their animated counterparts, with the Namco version looking more like the various humanoid designs depicted in some of the early merchandising of the character. Also, in the Bally Midway version are the Pac family's pets, Chomp Chomp the dog and Sourpuss the cat. These characters do not appear at all in the Namco release, which is the version we have at the arcade. Pac-Land is extremely colorful, which is befitting as it has elements of that animated series. Some of the gameplay mechanics in the game would also appear in Super Mario Bros. A mere year later. Although Pac-Land didn't reach the same heights of popularity as Nintendo's side-scrolling platformer did, obviously. Pac-Land was not an arcade game that I was ever lucky enough to experience in the arcades of my youth. The first time I ever had a chance to play it was thanks to 1997's Namco Museum Volume 4. Although, when I arrived for work at the Arcadia Retrocade a couple years back, it was defined that we had the cabaret-style Pac-Land cabinet. It quickly became one of my favorite arcade games, one that just kept surprising me with hidden secrets in the game. More on that in just a bit. I mentioned that Pac-Land was one of the oddities of the Pac-Man family of games at the beginning of this episode, as, like Professor Pac-Man or Super Pac-Man, Pac-and-Pal, and in regards to home consoles, with the likes of Pac-Attack, the gameplay does not involve eating up dots in a maze like in the 1980 original. Furthermore, Pac-Land features no joystick whatsoever, or trackball, but instead it features two run buttons. One for running left, and the other for running right, in addition to a jump button. Curiously enough, the flyer released in North America by Bally Midway mentions a two-way joystick in the features description of the cabinet. Yet, the photograph provided features the cabinet with only the two directional buttons. Actually, it appears that besides the cabaret-style cabinet that we have at the arcade, the traditional cabinet featured two sets of buttons for players on the left side of the cabinet and those on the right. Pac-Land tasks one to two players, taking alternate turns with helping Pac-Man travel from his home and family to reach Fairyland. The reason is, a fairy has lost her way from her magical land, and Pac-Man must help her get back home, doing so by hiding under his hat as he makes his way through cityscapes, mountains, woods, across lakes, through deserts, and even a castle. Granted, this won't be that easy, as Pac-Man has to avoid various pitfalls like quicksand, collapsing bridges, and even malfunctioning fire hydrants, and more will attempt to halt the player's quest to return the fairy to Fairyland. Of course, Pac-Man also has to be wary of his more standard foes, the Ghost Monsters gang, made up of Inky, Clyde, Blinky, Pinky, as well as Sue, who first showed up in 1982's Ms. Pac-Man. As I've already said, this isn't your typical Pac-Man game. So, besides Sue, who is methodically chasing you from behind in every stage, the other ghost monsters appear in automobiles, airplanes, UFOs, and even on pogo sticks. By pressing the run button in the desired direction, the player will begin to move across the screen. Stages of Pac-Land are divided up into trips, with three of the stages requiring Pac-Man to constantly head towards the right side of the screen to reach the end of the level, and the fourth being a return home trip, where the player must travel leftward. Now, you are able to go right and left to your heart's content. In fact, sometimes you have to double back a little to pick up a power-up or one of the hidden secrets in the game. A couple of taps of that run button will do just that. It will help Pac-Man build up a good burst of speed. After you are moving at a good pace, you can just hold down the run button. No need to keep tapping it. If you need to suddenly stop, though, you will of course have to tap the run button in the alternate direction. To complicate matters even further, there is a timer at the bottom of the screen. What looks like to me to be slowly deteriorating miniature power pellets. If you reach the end of a stage before the last has disappeared, you will receive bonus points. In addition, you won't automatically lose a life if the timer completely counts down. But once that last pellet is gone, Sue speeds up a great deal, and you will be hard-pressed to get away from her before reaching the end of the stage. Reaching the end of a stage, the first two rounds of every trip, the player will come to a large billboard that reads break time. As the music comes to a close and the remainder of your time is turned into bonus points, if you manage to jump as the game music ends, you will also receive bonus points depending on where you are when it ends. For example, if the player is just about to touch the ground as the final note ends, you will get 7,650 points. Obviously, the jump button is just that, and the player will be able to help Pac-Man hop atop moving cars driven by ghosts, and even safely on top of the ghosts themselves if they're careful. The jump button is also part of, at least for me, the hardest part of certain stages in Pac-Land, those moments when you have to time your jump on the springboard to safely cross over the various pawns in the game. I've lost so many reserves of lives on what sounds like a simple action. When the player begins to cross over the springboard, it will drop down and darken in color. When pressing the jump button after that, depending on where you are on the springboard, you will leap up into the air, necessitating the need to furiously pound on the run button to keep airborne, or you'll find yourself plummeting into the water or deadly quicksand below. The jump button is used a lot in the game, and normally for just quick hops over stationary objects like the fire hydrants in the city trips or tree stumps in the forest areas of a stage. However, at the conclusion of the third trip, when Pac-Man meets the Queen of Fairyland, he is bestowed a wondrous gift, a pair of red and winged boots. Pressing the jump button now on the fourth stage, or the return home trip, will allow Pac-Man to, in effect, fly in the game. Rapidly pressing the jump button will cause the player to levitate upwards. Pac-Man can, in the early stages, constantly jump up and glide in the air on the way home, avoiding obstacles on the ground on his return trip, although he'll have to be careful of the various ghosts in the air while doing so. Of late on this show, it seems like I've said this an awful lot, but it bears repeating, especially in the case of Pac-Land. While the basics are super easy to pick up, mastering them is an entirely different matter. Now, before I delve further into both the enemies and stages of Pac-Land, it should go without saying that if Pac-Man jumps into a ghost, is caught by Sue, falls into the water, or is hit by a water geyser and dragged under, the player will lose a life. Thankfully, Pac-Man can come across power pellets at various points in a stage. A quick hop up to eat one, and the ghosts will naturally turn blue and start to flee for their lives, until the pellet wears off. If the ghosts were in an airplane or on a pogo stick, when you scarf down that power pellet, they'll slowly descend to the bottom of the screen. The power pellet doesn't last that long, so it usually means you'll have to jump up and chomp them in the air. Gobbling up the ghost first nets the player 200, 400, 800, 1600, 3200, and then 7,650 points for each ghost he eats afterwards. Once a ghost has been well and truly chomped, their eyes will float off towards the left-hand side of the screen, but they'll quickly return. By the way, if you make sure that Sue is the fifth ghost to be devoured, you'll not only get that 3,200 points, but a lucky Pac-Man icon will appear as well. It's a Pac-Man symbol with an L in its mouth. Grabbing this will give you all your bonus points remaining on your timer, as well as completely refilling the timer again. This is a good way to rack up those points early in the game. Okay, I'll try to make this breakdown of the various locations in the game as concise as possible. There are 7 areas that the player will travel through in Pac-Land. Trip 1 always finds Pac-Man traveling through Pac-Town. The player must hop over fire hydrants and ghosts in old-fashioned automobiles. Pac-Man can leap over the cars or jump up on top of them and take a little ride back and forth on the screen, assuming Sue doesn't come up from behind and cost the player a life. In later stages, the ghost monsters start appearing in double-decker buses. You'll need to be running to successfully jump up on top of them. Not to mention, the fire hydrants will not only begin to appear stacked on top of one another to make it harder to jump over them, but they will sometimes fire off a jet of water that Pac-Man has to leap over. Otherwise, he will be caught at the front of the water blast and 99% of the time carried right into a waiting ghost. In addition, ghosts will appear in windows and attempt to drop mini versions of themselves on you. Jumping on the fire hydrants in Pac-Town will reveal cherries in the windows of the various houses and buildings. Fruits are only worth points, and are normally always hidden. The cherries, when eaten in a row, are worth 100, 300, 500, and then 1,000 points. After the fourth is devoured, the scoring multiplier is reset and you can rack them up again. In fact, in the stages, you can find all manner of fruits. Like I mentioned with the cherries in the first trip, there are also strawberries worth 300, 500, 1,000, and 1,500 points, oranges worth 500, 1,000, 1,500, and 2,000 points, apples will get you 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, then 2,500 points, and the melons will get you 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, and finally 3,000 points. Ghosts can also show up in airplanes. They too drop mini ghosts, like bombs. If Pac-Man comes in contact with these foes, he will lose a life. If you are very careful, you can actually land on top of the head of both the ghosts in the planes, as well as those mini ghosts. But it's risky. Now then, here's where I'll reveal another secret. On your first trip through the Pac-Town, you will encounter a fire hydrant just after the first power pellet. After eating the pellet, and then hopefully those ghosts, the mini-ghosts turn blue too, so you can eat them as well. When you go back to that fire hydrant, hop over it and begin pushing it to the left. It will start to move, and after a few seconds, you'll see that Pac-Man's fedora has been replaced with a baseball helmet. And now, with that baseball helmet on, you can let those airplanes drop those miniature ghosts on you all day long. Not only are you safe from the little guys, but you will get 300 points for each one that pops against that helmet. However, just like with the magic boots, if you let the timer run out or happen to lose a life, you also lose your power-ups. You will also lose your power-ups after completing the fourth stage of every trip, the actual return of Pac-Man to his wife and baby Pac-Man at their house. By the way, power pellets can appear in all environments except for the castle stages. Another power-up that can be dropped by the ghosts in planes is rather special indeed. It doesn't happen often, but sometimes those pesky ghosts will drop a Galaxian instead of a mini-ghost. Grabbing this item as it comes down will immediately net you 7,650 points. You might notice that 7,650 points pops up quite a bit. That is because it's Namco's name in Goro Always. I bet that I just butchered that pronunciation. It's a type of Japanese wordplay, in this case with a numeric substitution. In the return home on your first trip, stage 4, if you hover over a certain location with those magic winged boots, you will cause a special pack to show up. A Pac-Man icon that is similar to the lucky version, except instead of an L, there is an S. This will grant a player an immediate extra life. You can also do this on stage 16. The second location players will travel through is the forest. Interestingly enough, in this stage, the forest scrolls in front of the player instead of behind. I bring this up because it can lead to some issues seeing ghosts if you're not paying attention. As previously mentioned, there are tree stumps that Pac-Man must hop over, and much like those fire hydrants, can sometimes be moved to reveal a power-up or bonus item. Two new items to talk about are the transparency power-up, which makes it look like Pac-Man has become invisible. This makes him temporarily invincible to ghost attacks. There are also balloons that can be released, 6 in total, that begin to float upwards. You have to be quick to grab them all. 5 of those balloons are worth only 100 points apiece when you nab them. One, though, will net the player, you guessed it, 7,650 points. In some stages, you will also come across ponds in the forest that you will have to navigate with that dreaded springboard. And in later stages, the forest will be in darkness, with a swath of light the only way to see the ghost monsters in front of you. Speaking of those bad guys, while obviously you will have Sue in pursuit from the rear, you will have to contend with ghosts and UFOs, and even on pogo sticks. Those UFOs will move up and down as they travel from one side of the screen to the next. Remember, you can hop up on the top of the heads of the ghosts if you are careful. Sometimes, this will help you get away from the dangers on the ground. The pogo ghosts act in similar fashion, but they will not always move forward, so the player will have to time running underneath them. Furthermore, they are generally in groups. Personally, I've always had more trouble with these enemies than the ghosts and the UFOs, especially in the forests. Next up is the mountain ranges. Pac-Man can nimbly hop up the leveled inclines that make up the mountains themselves, but the player will have to contend with log bridges that will begin to crumble in turn, so that Pac-Man must race and leap across the gaps that open up. If a player is too slow, they will either fall into the chasms below the bridge, or find they now have no way to cross the chasm itself. There are also small sections of rolling logs. These raise up and down in the air, and when the player lands on them, Pac-Man will start moving in the direction the logs are rolling. So, you have to be careful, or you could be swept off and plunge once again into a chasm and lose a life. In later stages, you will also have clouds to jump on that also rise and lower, and even floating logs in lakes. These areas require you to be masterful in your jumps to avoid missing them and landing in the drink. To complicate matters, you will find those ghosts and airplanes appearing, so you have to watch your jump when at the top of the mountain ranges, as well as avoiding those mini ghosts that they can drop, assuming you don't have that baseball helmet. I've already mentioned the ponds, but in some stages, you will encounter an entire level of them, having to time that leap off the springboard just right. Generally, fruit will also appear as you jump, not only allowing you to gain points, but you can judge by their height if you're able to collect them as you're pounding those run buttons to keep your own height up. This way, you will know whether you're going to reach the other side of the pond safely. On trip 8, and then every fourth trip after that, you will encounter a pond with no springboard. That's because you should either have the magical boots or attempt to jump atop a ghost in an airplane to safely cross over. Ponds are frequently found in the other environments as well, as are sections of desert. Deserts do have cactus of varying heights that Pac-Man can jump on and over, as well as being able to push some of them to one side and reveal hidden power-ups and bonus points. The ghost monsters can appear in airplanes, UFOs, and even on those pogo sticks, too. The main threat in the desert trips are when the quicksand shows up. You will know you're near such an area when you see a skull on the ground. If Pac-Man comes in contact with a skull, he will lose a life. Jumping in front of one will usually result in the player beginning to be dragged down by the quicksand, with the skull starting to laugh. You can avoid this by constantly hitting that jump button or using, say, a cactus to leap over the dangerous area. There are some desert stages where you can use a springboard in an attempt to cross over the dangerous area as well. The bridges in Pac-Land cover large areas of water, the only thing keeping a player dry and above that deadly water. I guess Pac-Man can't swim. These stone structures have ledges that the player can cross, although there are numerous gaps that Pac-Man has to jump over. Beyond that, there are the ghost monsters he has to keep an eye on. The player needs to watch out for the geysers of water that erupt and shoot upwards. If Pac-Man is caught in this blast, you'll have to start wailing on the jump button in an attempt to escape and find solid footing. Otherwise, you are dragged down by it. There can also be fire hydrants on these stages. Firing off blasts of water horizontally, you'll need to avoid like in Pac-Town. There are also special power-ups in the bridge levels, and these are in the form of collectible sailing galleons. When a player grabs these, it will extend certain ledges in the level, meaning you won't have to jump as far over gaps in some cases. Last but not least, the seventh type of area, or stage, that players will traverse is the castle. The first time you encounter the castle will be in stage 14. These areas are a bit like the bridge levels, although you won't have to worry about plummeting into water. Instead, you'll need to collect keys to open gates, and worry about running out of time before you reach the end, as Sue is the only ghost monster to contend with. After that first encounter with the Stage 14 castle, every single time you encounter it afterwards will be in pitch darkness, with only that little bit of light to reveal where you're going. By the way, these environments that I've just described are what you can experience on your return trip home as well, on those fourth stages of every trip. Generally, this will be a mix of those environments. The castle, however, will never be included in the trips back home. If you manage to clear Trip 8, remember, that means 32 stages, the game will keep going, beginning on stage 17, or trip 5, at a much higher difficulty. I've left one other secret to the last because of what it can do. On stage 1, if you jump in the right spot, a beautiful red flower will bloom from the ground. What this does is, I have no idea whatsoever. And I've been looking online, and it appears that no one knows what this does. You can only see it in stage 1, however. Whew. I hope that was concise, friends. For what it might be worth, Mark Mendez holds the world record for Pac-Land with a staggering 4,150,400 points, which was achieved back on May 14th in 1986. Interestingly enough, Pac-Land allows high score holders 5 letters instead of the standard 3 for initials. You could even add a Pac-Man and a ghost symbol if you so wish. Now, at the Arcadia Retrocade, our high score holder happens to be...
Hello, Mr. Dillinger. Thanks for coming back early.
Retroist Vault Computer? It's been over 3 years now. The name is Vic, not Mr. Dillinger. Man, Edward Dillinger hasn't been your boss in nearly 37 years. What is up, though? Is everything okay?
I've got a little challenge for you. A new recruit. It's a tough case, but I want him treated in the usual manner. Train him for the games. Let him hope for a while, and blow him away.
Wait, is Henry Holder here already?
He's a user. He pushed me in the real world. Somebody pushes me, I push back.
I'm not gonna do that, Retro's Vault Computer. Now, could you just send Henry down?
We have transport.
Hey, Henry! Welcome to the Retro's Vault!
Woohoo! What a rush!
I'm so glad you could make time to come visit us, Henry. I know you're here for a rather special reason, one related to the arcade, but we'll let you tell the listeners all about that in just a few minutes. Henry, tell me, what is the first video game you can remember playing?
That is a very good question. I believe it was Super Mario Bros. For the NES. It was when I was 6 years old, back in 1987, I believe.
Henry, what did you like best about Super Mario Bros.?
Awesome power-ups, amazing stages, being able to storm the castle, beat the bad guy, save the princess, and be the super cool hero.
What did you think when you heard that a retro arcade was opening up in your neck of the woods?
My first thought, get out! And then, where can I find it?
Henry, what would you say is your favorite game here at the arcade?
You know, there's actually so many that I like, it's actually hard to pick a favorite, but one that comes to mind is Satan's Hollow, because I have so many scores on it that you could say that I'm its favorite player.
I believe I mentioned you were the high score holder on the Satan's Hollow episode, Henry. Listeners, if Pac-Land happens to be the first episode of this podcast you've ever listened to, you might not know that Henry Holder is one of the three regular high score holders at the Arcadia Retrocade. Besides Henry, there is John Munkus, as well as Michael Dietrich.
And that's why I'm here, Vic. I'm calling Michael Dietrich out. I'm challenging him to beat my high score on Pac-Land. So come and get it, Michael. I'll be waiting.
Well, you've heard it here first, friends. The esteemed Henry Holder has just called out the equally esteemed Michael Dietrich to take a high score challenge at the Arcadia Retrocade. If I recall correctly, Henry, you managed to rack up a rather impressive 446,990 points.
That's right, Vic. Stage 22 at an all-time high.
Thanks for being on the show, my friend. You've definitely done something that hasn't been done on the show before. If you're ready to take off, you just need to step on the vault teleport platform over there.
No need, Vic.
So you can...
Now I have to explain to the Retroist why there's a brand new hole in the vault wall.
And now, these messages...
Thank goodness for Pac-Man pasta from Chef Boyardee.
Pac-Man pasta?
Little spaghetti shaped like us.
Delicious.
And because Chef Boyardee's packed with goodness, it's great for when we have to eat and run.
Pac-Man pasta from Chef Boyardee. With meatballs, without meatballs, or chicken flavor.
Thank goodness for Pac-Man pasta.
Thank goodness for Chef Boyardee.
Me, Pac-Man.
And sneak what's new on ABC this Saturday morning.
Geronimo!
With special guest star Henry Winkler.
Hang in there, troops. The Fonz is here.
And Mr. Crow.
Willie Tyler and Lester. And some very special appearances.
Me on TV?
By some very special friends like Scooby. And Scrappy-Doo, everybody's favorite gang.
We are.
The Little Rascals. Mort.
Doink, 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 doink.
And Mindy. Puppy's New Adventures.
Help has arrived.
The Fonz teams up with Laverne and Shirley and meet the greatest chomper in cartoon history. All on the Pack Preview Party.
Well, before Henry left, I should have mentioned that he most definitely holds the high score for Pac-Land at the arcade. For now, I'm surprised that I never knew about Pac-Land until back in 1997. Because, while there was no way I could play the 1985 Famicom version, ports of the arcade game were released to the Amstrad CPC in 1988, as well as the Commodore 64 and MSX. In 1989, they released versions for the Commodore Amiga and the Atari ST. The TurboGrafx-16 received a port in 1990, and so too did the Atari Lynx a year later. There were also handheld LCD games made, and even a board game, although I believe these last two were Japanese exclusives. Just recently, you could visit Pac-Lan, thanks to it being a stage, in both Super Smash Bros. For the Wii U back in 2014 and Super Smash Bros. Ultimate just last year in 2018. At the arcade, due to the cabinet's diminutive size, Shay hasn't placed Pac-Lan in the showcase row of Pac-Man games. Instead, it's up on the deck, where we keep the likes of the Sinistar environmental cabinet and cocktail games. More importantly, it's located near the Atari couch, which means it gets lots of attention. Due to its control scheme, we generally have to demonstrate how it's played, and it also lets us show off just a bit when we show a player one of the secrets. In all seriousness, Pac-Lan is an amazing game, and while I've never been able to reach the high scores and stages like Henry Holder, I just have a lot of fun with it. The music from the 1980s animated series mixes perfectly with the colorful and cartoon-like graphics, although I will admit I get a little bent out of shape with those darn springboards and pond stages. I really think Pac-Lan is worth your time to go and check out. I personally feel it has much to offer in terms of gameplay, and it's certainly not the easiest classic arcade title. Plus, it deserves some respect as being a little of a predecessor to the likes of Super Mario Bros. And friends, I think that is about all I can share with you about Pac-Lan. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the show. The Diary of an Arcade Employee is available on iTunes and even Spotify. So, if you have a moment, why not subscribe and help us get the word out on the show by leaving a review and some comments? Helping the podcast reach new listeners is always appreciated. You can find out more about the Arcadia Retrocade by visiting Facebook. Or for daily posts, you can check out the Diary of an Arcade Employee podcast Facebook page. I share all manner of vintage arcade and home console fun multiple times a day. If you have any feedback or comments about the podcast, you can always reach me on Facebook or throw me an email at vicsage@retroist.com. You can also often find me posting videos of the arcade on my Instagram account, which is simply vicsage_. I, of course, want to thank the Retroist, not just for hosting this show, but for providing a spot on the internet where you can visit throughout the week to find some of the best retro-related articles and podcasts. Lexi and Lily have sent in a request for the next game I'll discuss. So until then, have a token on me as I play a clip from the game I'll discuss on the next show. This has been a Retroist production. Thank you for listening, and have a better one. Goodbye.
End of line.